All right, welcome to another deep dive. Today, we're tackling something I think a lot of you have probably thought about, at least a little bit, God as a warrior. But we're not just going to kind of skim the surface here. We're going to go deep using excerpts from Dr. Tremper Longan's lecture series on the topic. Now, I got to say, this isn't your typical Sunday school stuff. Dr. Longman breaks his whole God as a warrior thing down into five distinct phases throughout the Bible. And let me tell you, it already has my mind spinning. I have a feeling that some of these phases, well, they might even spark a bit of debate and discussion among us, you know?
Yeah.
So get ready. It's going to be a fascinating ride.
It definitely sounds like it'll make us think. So before we dive in, maybe we should give folks a bit of background. Who exactly is Dr. Tremper Longman, and why should we listen to him on this?
Yeah, good point. Well, he's a retired Old Testament professor. He's taught at Westminster Theological Seminary and Westmont College. Pretty impressive, huh? And that's not all. He was also involved in the New Living Translation of the Bible, you know, working specifically on the Psalms and wisdom literature. It seems like he's made a career out of being fascinated by this whole divine warrior idea.
Interesting. You know, the Psalms and wisdom literature, they're packed with poetic imagery and metaphors. And those are crucial if we're going to understand how ancient people thought about God. They weren't always so direct back then, right?
Oh, absolutely. And that's where this thing called biblical theology comes in. Dr. Longman explains that it's about trying to grasp how God reveals himself throughout the entire Bible. It's not just looking at verses in isolation. It's about seeing how the literature, the history, and the theology, all of it is intertwined. And it means recognizing that, yeah, sure, God's most perfect revelation is Jesus. But the Old Testament reveals God in all sorts of ways through actions and these metaphors we've been talking about.
So it's not about taking every word literally, right?
Mm-hmm.
We need to look deeper, try to understand the truths those metaphors are pointing to.
Exactly. I mean, think about it. The Bible uses all sorts of metaphors for God: shepherd, father, king, husband, and then suddenly, bam, warrior. It's a little more intense than the others, wouldn't you say?
It definitely grabs your attention. And the way these metaphors are used throughout the Bible, it can be surprising, to say the least. Remember that image in Psalm 78, where it compares God to, like, a drunk soldier waking up?
Oh, yeah. You read that and you're like, wait, what? But that's what metaphors do, right? They make us stop and think about God in new ways, even if those ways make us squirm a little sometimes.
Totally. All right, so let's get to the heart of what Dr. Longman's saying here. He lays out these five distinct phases of the God as a warrior theme throughout the Bible. What's that first phase, the one that kicks it all off?
Phase one is probably what pops into most people's heads when they hear that phrase, God as a warrior. You know, that image of God fighting the literal flesh and blood enemies of Israel. Think epic battles and divine intervention.
So this is where we see God portrayed as a powerful protector, shielding his people from their enemies. But before we get into the specifics of phase one, Dr. Longman does something I find really interesting.
What's that?
He actually takes a step back and talks about how wars were fought back in the Old Testament, like what happened before, during, and after a battle. He makes the point that if we want to grasp what it meant for God to be seen as a warrior, we need to understand that historical context.
That's a fascinating approach. So much of how we read the Bible is shaped by, you know, our modern worldview. But by learning about ancient warfare, we can sort of step into the shoes of the original audience and see how they would have understood these stories.
Yeah, it's like putting on a different pair of glasses, right? Oh. To see the text in a whole new light.
Exactly. So are you ready to journey back to those ancient battlefields and see what we can learn about God as a warrior?
Let's do it. Let's explore how those ancient practices shape our understanding of what God was doing in the Old Testament.
Okay, so we're stepping onto those ancient battlefields. What were some of the things that Dr. Longman highlights about how they waged war back then in the Old Testament?
Well, one thing that really jumps out is how important ritual purity was. You know, before going into battle, the Israelites, they'd go through these purification rituals to make sure they were right with God.
That's interesting. So it wasn't just about being physically strong and having a good strategy. Their spiritual state, it actually mattered. They believed it could affect the outcome of the battle.
Exactly. And this idea, it ties directly into the whole concept of God as a warrior. They believed that God was fighting right there alongside them, but only if they were, you know, properly prepared, if they'd gone through the purification rituals.
It almost sounds like a kind of covenant. God would fight for them, but they had to hold up their end of the deal by maintaining that ritual purity, like a two-way street.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Another fascinating aspect is this thing called the harem.
The harem. What's that?
It's often translated as, well, devoted to destruction. Basically, in certain battles, God commanded the Israelites to completely destroy their enemies and everything they had. People, animals, even their possessions.
Whoa, that's pretty intense. And I can see how that concept, the harem, it might be a little tough for people today to wrap their heads around. It seems so harsh, so unforgiving.
Oh, it definitely raises some tough questions. And it's really important that we approach these texts with sensitivity and, you know, with a willingness to grapple with how complex they are. But to really get it, we have to understand the ancient context. In the ancient Near East, warfare, it was brutal. It was total. The harem, you could see it as a way of saying that God was totally sovereign, that his judgment was absolute, especially over those who opposed him and his people.
So it was about God establishing his power and authority in a world where violence was just like the norm.
Exactly. And it's also a stark reminder that, well, God's ways aren't always our ways, are they? His justice can be severe, especially when he was dealing with those who had committed, you know, truly wicked acts.
Okay, that makes sense. But I'm curious about what happened after a battle. If the Israelites were victorious, what then?
Well, often they would have these rituals of thanksgiving and praise to God for giving them the victory.
So it wasn't like they were taking all the credit for themselves. They recognized that God had a hand in their success.
Absolutely. These post-battle rituals, they were all about reinforcing this idea. God was their protector, their defender, the one who ultimately gave them victory.
Okay, I'm starting to see how understanding all these ancient warfare practices can shed light on this whole God as a warrior idea. It wasn't just about brute force. There was a spiritual dimension to it, a sense of divine judgment and acknowledging that God was in control.
Yeah, exactly. Now, let's connect this back to those five phases Dr. Longman talks about. We've been focusing on phase one, where God fights for Israel. But remember, you mentioned earlier, there's a twist.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Phase two, it flips the whole script. God sometimes fights against Israel. Now, why would that be? It seems kind of counterintuitive.
Well, it highlights something crucial about the relationship between God and his people. God, he wasn't just a divine protector who just gave them whatever they wanted. He held them to a higher standard.
So it wasn't this one-sided relationship where God was always obligated to fight for them. He expected them to be faithful, to obey him.
Exactly. When they strayed from his commands, when they were doing things that were unjust, when they were worshiping idols, God responded with discipline, with judgment. And sometimes that meant allowing other nations to conquer them.
So even though God had rescued them from Egypt and fought for them when they were conquering Canaan, it wasn't like a free pass forever. There were consequences for their actions.
Right. And we see this pattern throughout the Old Testament, like in the book of Judges. It shows this cycle. Israel rebels, God judges them, they repent, and then God rescues them. It just keeps happening over and over.
Like God was constantly reminding them that he's both loving and just. He loves them, but he also expects them to live up to their end of the covenant.
Yeah, it paints a more complicated picture of God's relationship with Israel. And this whole idea of God fighting against his own people, it can be a lot to process.
It definitely challenges our assumptions about God always being on our side no matter what we do. But if God's fighting against his own people, does that mean it's all over for them? Is there no hope?
Well, that's where phase three comes in. Even in the midst of judgment, God offers hope. And he does it through the prophets. They start talking about a time in the future when God will fight for Israel again, when he'll deliver them from oppression and restore their fortunes.
So it's not all doom and gloom. Even when God disciplines them, he never completely gives up on them.
Right. These prophetic words, they point towards a future hope, a future where God will finally triumph over evil and set up his kingdom of peace and righteousness.
It's like a promise that God's story with Israel isn't finished yet, that something even more amazing is coming.
And that something more amazing, well, it starts to take shape in the New Testament with the arrival of Jesus. He's the one who really embodies this whole God as a warrior theme, but in a totally new way.
So how does Jesus fit into all of this? Does he show up with a sword and shield, ready to lead an army against the Roman Empire?
Quite. I mean, there are some symbolic references to Jesus wielding a sword, but his weapons, they're mostly spiritual. He's here to fight a different kind of battle.
No.
A battle against the spiritual forces that enslave humanity.
So phase four takes the battlefield from the physical world to the spiritual realm. It's not about conquering earthly enemies anymore. It's about confronting the powers of darkness themselves. How did Jesus actually engage in this spiritual warfare?
Well, think about his temptation in the wilderness. He goes head to head with the devil, not with physical force, but with scripture and this unwavering faith. He doesn't give in to temptation to abandon his mission, to choose power and safety over obedience to God.
It's such a powerful image of spiritual resistance,
yeah.
of standing strong against temptation, even when you feel like you have nothing left.
And then there are his encounters with demons. He just casts them out with a word, showing everyone his authority over the spiritual realm, breaking the chains of oppression and setting people free from spiritual bondage.
It's like he's tearing down the very structures of evil, exposing how powerless it is in the face of God's love and authority.
Mm.
So in phase four, we're seeing Jesus as the ultimate warrior, but he's fighting a different kind of fight, right?
Yeah.
And he's using different kinds of weapons, love, truth, forgiveness, compassion.
Exactly. He's confronting evil not with violence, but with this radical grace. It's like he's turning the world's idea of power upside down.
Okay, so Jesus has fought this cosmic battle against the forces of darkness. But does his victory mean that evil is defeated once and for all? What about all the suffering and injustice we still see in the world? Doesn't feel like evil is gone.
That's a really important question, and it leads us to the final phase. Phase five, Jesus, he definitely defeats the powers of darkness through his death and resurrection, but the battle isn't completely over just yet.
So the war is still going on. But how does that work if Jesus already won?
Think of it this way. Jesus won the decisive battle, the most important one. But we're still seeing the consequences of that victory play out in history.
So it's like the effects of his victory are still rippling outward.
Exactly. The full and final victory will happen when he returns in glory, when he comes back to establish his kingdom once and for all.
So phase five is about the ultimate resolution, that final triumph over evil. But while we're waiting for that, what are we supposed to do? Are we just passive bystanders in this ongoing cosmic battle?
Not at all. We're called to be warriors alongside Christ, to fight against injustice, to spread his message of love, to live lives that reflect his kingdom values.
So we're not off the hook. We have a part to play in this spiritual warfare. But how do we fight without resorting to the kind of violence we see in the Old Testament? How do we do it differently?
Our weapons are different. We fight with love, compassion, forgiveness, and this unwavering commitment to truth and justice. We stand up for those who are being marginalized, speak out against oppression, and work to bring healing and reconciliation to a world that's so broken.
So we're called to be warriors, but warriors of a different kind. Fighting for good in a world that, honestly, can feel pretty dark sometimes. We've talked about what weapons we're not supposed to use, you know, that violence and judgment we see in the Old Testament. But what does it actually look like to fight with love and compassion and forgiveness? How do those become our weapons in this spiritual battle?
That's a great question. And it really challenges us to think differently about what it means to be powerful and what it means to win. You see, in God's kingdom, strength isn't about dominating others or controlling them. It's about humility, service, and being willing to sacrifice yourself for others.
So it's like a totally different definition of warfare. We're not trying to conquer our enemies. We're trying to overcome evil with good.
Exactly. Think about those classic images of Jesus, you know, washing his disciples' feet or offering forgiveness to the people who were crucifying him. Those are acts of radical humility. Radical love, and they completely challenge the way the world sees power.
Those images are so powerful because they show us that true strength comes from a place of vulnerability, from compassion. But how does that translate into our everyday lives? How do we actually live that out? It seems hard.
Well, it starts with recognizing the battlefields we're called to fight on. It might not be literal battlefields with swords and shields, but there are still places where darkness is winning. Where there's injustice in our communities, our workplaces, even in our own hearts.
So it's about being aware of the brokenness around us and inside us too, and then making a choice to respond with love and compassion instead of giving into fear or being judgmental.
You got it. It might mean standing up for someone who's being treated unfairly or helping someone who's struggling. It might mean choosing to forgive someone instead of holding on to bitterness or showing grace to someone who's hurt you.
These are those quiet, everyday acts of courage. The things that might seem small, but can really make a difference in the world. It's about choosing to be light in the darkness, to be a force for good when everything around you feels bad.
Yeah, and it's not always easy. I mean, let's be real. There will be times when you feel discouraged, when it feels like the darkness is just too strong. But it's important to remember, we're not fighting alone. We have a powerful ally in God, and he's already won the decisive victory.
That's a good reminder. It means that even when we're struggling, even when we feel like we're failing, we can still have hope. We can trust that God is working through us, even in those small acts of love and compassion, even when we mess up.
Exactly. And as we engage in these spiritual battles, as we choose to fight with love and grace, something happens. We start to become more like Christ. We reflect his love more. We become part of his transforming power in the world.
So this whole journey of exploring God as a warrior, it's taken us to some interesting places, from ancient battlefields to what Jesus did, and now to our own lives. It's made us think differently about power, about victory, about what it means to be a warrior in God's kingdom.
And I hope it's left you feeling both challenged and encouraged. Challenged to live out your faith with courage and compassion, and encouraged to know that you're not alone in this fight. We have a God who fights for us, and he's invited us to join him in fighting for a better world.
So as you go about your day, think about this. What are the battlefields you're called to step onto? What are the places where you can make a difference? And what weapons will you choose? Remember, even the smallest acts of love and kindness, those can be the most powerful weapons of all.